All right, welcome. We're going to get started because we have a lot that we want to do. So as I see some people are still gathering and sitting, I'm going to just give a few announcements and play something at the beginning here that's just kind of fun, and then we'll get into it. My name is Joshua Viss. I am the host, program director, co-founder of Still Processing. And this is what Still Processing does mainly right now, is it holds these monthly gatherings around, I guess, what we deem to be really important topics or interesting topics, like the one we're having tonight. And we are trying to foster curiosity and kindness through conversation and community. We value humility, which I know Daryl has studied. Hospitality, I'm forgetting one, honesty, and hope. And we believe a better world is possible, and we want to help create that better world in the little way that we can through these types of conversations and through this little community that we started. Okay, I'm going to do in a week, I'm going to do a Still Processing Talks Politics. So that's going to be March 13 at 7, and we'll send out Monday and of next week, we will send out the Zoom link. It's just going to be an informal conversation. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but there's a lot going on. The end of democracy, just little things, you know, end of agencies, insanity, really, is how it feels to me. But tonight we're not going to focus on that, so we're going to do that in a week. And then our next gathering is pushed back from our usual first Thursday of the month to the 17th of April. I should have double-checked to make sure that's right, but there's time in case I get it wrong. It's just that the first two Thursdays are spring break for local schools, and that includes me and my family. So we're going to push back to April 17, and that'll be with Cynthia Martinez. She's a local filmmaker, journalist, activist. She'll be great, and we look forward to that. Okay. I'm going to play this, and then I'm going to introduce these two.
We're in the middle of a hostile government takeover. I want to talk about it, but I'll be late for work. And if you're saying, wait a minute, who we have to stop this? We have one, but you didn't want the lady in office. Now that we're a part of a Nigerian prince scam, surprise, surprise, it ended up being a white man. Oh, I just want to know, what the hell do I do? Probably drink.
Probably, yes. We're all coping in various ways, I imagine. I know it's absurd. I know it's painful. I know it's scary, what's happening. I feel that every day, honestly, about what's happening in our country. And I just don't want that to go unspoken as we start here, because I know it's... This is not normal. What's happening now is not normal. And I am grateful to be joined by Daryl and Sarah Van Tongeren today for our subject about flourishing after leaving religion. Daryl is a PhD, professor of psychology, and director of the Frost Center for Social Science Research at Hope College. He studies big questions central to being human, including meaning, religion, and virtues. He has published nearly 250 scientific papers and 4 books on these themes, including the one we're focusing on tonight, Done, How to Flourish After Leaving Religion. His research has been funded by numerous external grants, and he has earned several international research awards and been named fellow of several prestigious, I lost my place, professional organizations. That's a fun place to lose it, isn't it? Right after prestigious. He lives in Holland with Sarah, and he enjoys running, biking, reading, and making his own hot sauce. Do you want to say more about the hot sauce?
Yeah, it's spicy. It's good, yeah.
Okay. Straightforward. And Sarah is the founder of a telehealth-based mental health group practice called the Flourishing Collective. She has co-authored a book titled The Courage to Suffer, co-authored with Daryl, as well as a peer-reviewed theory paper on the existential positive psychology model of suffering. She is currently working on an upcoming book to be published in 2026 by APA on helping therapists support their clients through religious change. Sarah primarily works with female-identifying adults who are wanting to rediscover their identity and increase their own sense of empowerment. Often, Sarah's clients are at a crossroad brought on by suffering. Sarah specializes in working with therapists and pastors, among many other things for both of them. Thank you guys so much for being here. All right, I'm going to play another short TikTok. This is the first one was as well. Read the first thing before it starts, because that one goes away a little bit too quickly. Some of the other ones do as well, but you'll get the gist of it. And I just want to say this type of thing, I come across this type of thing on TikTok all the time. Variations of this. So enjoy.
So this is a TikTok, and it features a young woman with her daughter who is about 1 year old. And she plays scenes of them together. And over top of that, there's music. And then over top of that, she is putting text that is explaining something that's important to her, which I'm going to read on top of the music. So this is what she wrote over top of scenes of her playing with her daughter. One of the things I'm most proud of in raising my daughter, we won't be raising her in religion. Our Sundays will be ours. She won't grow up believing that she is broken in need of fixing. She won't be fearful of being left behind and losing her whole family to the rapture. She won't have to sit alone with a stranger 10 times her age, confessing sins she doesn't fully understand. She won't have fear about eternal punishment over mistakes made in her life. She'll be free to choose her own beliefs without the threat of hell or rejection from her family. She can decide her own spirituality and ethics without fear of disappointing a deity. She hopefully won't feel shame over natural human emotions. I know I won't be able to protect my daughter from everything, but I will do my best to raise her with confidence, curiosity, and critical thinking, so she never has to live in fear, question her worth, or feel bound by beliefs she didn't choose for herself.
So these are the religious trends that TikTok illustrates, which is there are increasing amounts of people leaving their religious tradition. In the United States, that's mainly Christianity, but it is happening in other religions as well, but we'll be focusing mainly on Christianity. So in the past 30 years, number of Christians in the U.S. has dropped from 90 to 63. By 2070, you were saying this earlier, Christianity will no longer be the majority religion. Most religious nuns, 78% of them, were raised religious before walking away. And 1 in 3 individuals raised Christians leave their faith by the time they reach age 30. So I thought maybe we'd start just by saying, how did you guys get into this particular area of research?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I studied meaning and religion for many, many years, often studying kind of the function of religion, what does it do. But then I got tenure, and I was on a run with one of my friends, and he's like, you know, what's something you've always wanted to study but you've never studied? And I'm at Hope College, and I was like, well, I've always wanted to study people leaving religion. And he's like, well, now that you have tenure, you should just go do that. And so I was like, well, that's a great idea. And so a colleague and I wrote a grant from the John Templeton Foundation, got $250,000 grant. And just, I mean, when we applied for this grant, we had to convince the program officer that this was something that was happening. And we thought maybe 4 or 8% of people would have left religion.
What year was this?
We probably wrote the proposal in 2017. And then we did some cross-cultural research, and when it came back, we found that 1 in 5 people had left religion. And time and again, almost every single time we run a study, it's 1 in 5. And we thought, I think we're onto something. So that's how I kind of came into it in the research perspective.
Yeah, and I came into it more in the practice perspective. We moved to Holland in 2012, and I got lucky that I was through Daryl, some of Daryl's connections and people we had met, I got to start to see some clients that were questioning some painfully religious teachings that they had experienced and seeing how it impacted them personally. And so I would say that's where it started my own, maybe our dinner conversations, and maybe where we started really thinking like, oh, is there something we can do about this? At the time, it was, I would even say the word deconstruction wasn't a word. I haven't done I don't know when that started colloquially. I mean, we could say, if you're interested, to know that even in the world of psychology, that word has not yet been scientifically sort of contained or measured. We're still pretty new in this. And so I would say for me, seeing my clients go through this, having, I would say, my own version of deconstruction, again, I didn't have the words or language for it. There's a deep personal aspect of this for me. I think we could share our story even of around Daryl's brother passed away unexpectedly of a genetic condition when we were still in graduate school. And I was working with children and families who had received a terminal or long-term diagnosis, and I noticed something shifting in me besides the grief, in which I started encountering people just understanding that the limits of what we have, even in our own, in my own field of psychology, didn't meet those needs. And so I think that's when Josh said we developed the existential positive psychology, or we're a part of that model, was understanding that, like, sometimes when you have this concept of what, how you think the world works, you don't even know you have it until it breaks. And seeing it broken with those clients over and over, seeing it breaking with me, made my heart tender towards people in that way, in a way that I hadn't had before.
Sorry, I turned mine off so I wouldn't be banging. So, but there was a personal, like, you guys were obviously interested in it professionally.
Yes.
Right, but as you hinted at, there was also some personal things that happened that probably enhanced your interest professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like Sarah said, so when my brother died when I was 27 or 28, and he was 34 and he had three kids under the age of six, that really just shattered my view of God, right? So if you were raised thinking that God is all loving, all powerful, and all knowing, okay, like the big three, then you kind of have to make sense of this horrible tragedy of, well, is God not all that loving? Is God not all that powerful? Is God not all that knowing? Is God just mean? Like, did God allow this to happen? Kind of unraveled a series of questions, of peeling things back. And the religious community wasn't super helpful.
No, in fact, it was horrible.
They would say things, like, I'm sure many of us have encountered this. Usually when people are suffering, people offer platitudes that they need to hear, not that the person suffering needs to hear. So they say things like, oh, I'm sure that God needed an angel. And I'm like, no, those kids needed a father. But it took me a while to realize it had more to do with them than me. So I think, yes, that kind of cracked some things open for us.
Well, and you were studying things like terror management theory and these really, I think, deep, heady kind of theories, and then to live it is another thing, right? And to see, I will say to my clients, we often aren't grateful for our head or our brain until we have a headache, and then our headache's over or migraine's over, and then where you wake up the next morning being like, oh, I'm so glad my migraine's gone. But we don't wake up every day saying, oh, I'm so glad my migraine's gone. And we don't know we have a fragile worldview until it starts to break and crack. And for many people, myself included, who was brought up in a very fundamental sort of belief system, I didn't have the tools or understanding of how to shape lots of things that religion provided, which we'll talk about that too.
I think that's excellent. Good. Yeah. Speaking of terror management, it's
yeah,
a great,
you should Google that one. It's a really good one.
I mean, it's
one.
A great way to segue to this, which is, you talk about there are five existential realities all humans have to come to terms with. Would you say a little bit about those?
Yeah, just briefly, we'll get really depressed. Is that okay? And then I promise to bring you most of the way out of it.
So very common here to feel depressed at Still Processing.
Oh, well,
I'll be honest.
I know, just ground
lately,
yourself.
Anyways. Yeah. Lately, anyways. The world is not helping.
Great. So, yeah, just indulge me for about 90 seconds. So like every animal, we're going to die. Womp womp. But unlike every other animal, we're gifted with sophisticated intellectual capabilities and the capacity for self-awareness, right? So we realize that we're a self, and we realize that we can reflect. So because of that, we have to come to terms with kind of five givens of what it means to be human. So the first given is we have to make decisions and live with the consequences of those decisions, even when we're not sure what the right answer is, right? Among competing attractive alternatives. So like, what should I major in college? What should my profession be? Whom should I partner with? Should I partner with someone? Should we have kids? Things like that. That's called freedom or groundlessness. That's the first fear. The second is isolation. So isolation is the idea that all of us are phenomenologically separate from one another, and there's this unbridgeable gap that none of us can quite know what it's like to be somebody else. Right? So what that means is that we enter into and leave this world completely and utterly alone. I said this was going to get depressing. So right now, each of us are having unique phenomenological experiences. You're wondering how much more depressing I'm going to get. I'm wondering if you know that I'm just kind of joking, but not really. Some of you are like, I should have eaten dinner before this, right? But no one really knows what it's like to be anybody else. The third big concern is identity. We all have to figure out who we are over the changing landscape of our life. But the good news is, the fourth fear is the one thing we absolutely know for certain is that all of us are going to die. Right? This is good news. Yes, we're all certain. Wow, this is a tough crowd. So we're all certain that we're going to die. And then what this should do, all four of these things should conspire to the next slide to give rise to the fear of meaninglessness. So all of us wonder whether or not life has any meaning whatsoever, if it's just some cruel, absurd joke. Okay, have any of you ever contemplated any of this at any point in your life? Some of you. Okay, great.
We're not alone, right?
Not alone. For me, it's usually in February, staring out my back window at 2 in the morning while the snow is coming down.
Yeah,
right? That's exactly right.
Correct.
Here's the deal. These things should create the potential for overwhelming anxiety that should absolutely incapacitate us as humans. We should be grappling for anti-anxiety medications the size of bagels, right? But we're not. Somehow we can just make our way through life. And the way that we do that is we construct and we adhere to cultural worldviews, right? And so part of our contention is the worldview that meets all of these needs the absolute best, I hate to say it, y'all, is religion. Religion checks off all of these boxes more than any of the other ones.
Which is why we are drawn to it, or have been, or those fundamental, like I think about my family of origin, drawn to those very fundamental beliefs of like, you can say, oh, I don't have to worry about dying because I'm going to live on forever, or, oh, I don't have to worry about who I am because I'm a child of God, right? There are these very quick ways. And so when we have these sufferings, a struggle that puts these cracks into it, we then no longer have that quick way to answer those questions. So life becomes pretty complicated real quick.
And if the whole goal of religion is to shield you from anxiety, like Sarah's saying, if you've jettisoned your religious beliefs, maybe you felt some anxiety. If any of you have changed your religious beliefs, you don't have to raise your hand. I can see the nodding. Some of you have experienced that anxiety.
And statistically, we know people that leave religion, their mental health is significantly worse, which often is used against people, right? To say, see, you shouldn't leave because, you know, you're going to be depressed. And it's, I like to sometimes think about it. People are most likely depressed already. And they're, what I think happens is you leave, you have a plummeting sense of self, and everything starts cracking. And as you start to hopefully deconstruct, that mental health for a period is going to be a lot of unhealth, but eventually you can reconstruct in a form that can start to answer these. Not in a neatly packaged thing, I don't think, unless you find another way to find a solution to this.
Yeah. And considering that, mm-hmm. It is surprising then that people are leaving religion. It is this sort of perfectly packaged meaning-making machine for meaning-making animals,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's happening.
Yeah, I would say too, it's what I see for most people, they tend to leave, well, and I think you're about to hit all of them, the different.
I am, yeah.
Okay, yeah. But most people are leaving because one of these things are happening, right?
Yeah.
Their worldview wasn't, whether it was a theological or a cultural reason, it wasn't, it was a neatly packaged, but it was too neat.
I see.
That's my thought on it.
Well, let's go through these. So cultural stagnation.
Yeah, this is what I call the four horsemen of religion's apocalypse. Right. So this is not the four horsemen of like the apocalypse. This is the four horsemen of religion's apocalypse. So if religion's going to end, which I don't think it will, but anyway, these are the four reasons. So the first one is cultural stagnation. So this is where people's beliefs are no longer aligned with their religious teachings. So people become more progressive, but their religious institutions tend to remain more conservative or stagnant.
Well, and we can even think about it. Like, the biggest thing we can start to think about is, right, when cultural stagnation around conversations of diversity and inclusion, cultural stagnation around women. I mean, we can even go back to, should women be a pastor, right? Like, that's cultural stagnation. We're talking about the ways we culturally stagnate against people with identities of LGBTQ, right? Cultural stagnation for people that don't have children, right? Ways that on one hand, I think when we talk about it, a lot of churches or places will say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's some extreme or liberal ideologies. And I always like to remind them, as a woman, we're still talking about whether women should be pastors or not. That's cultural stagnation. To the most basic degree, and all these other things. So it's about, you know, 250 years behind or something.
Right, and you have on here, of course, science, education.
Yes. Of course,
has been for decades. We've been fighting this battle.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a guy going into, a reporter, going into Congress and asking some random House reps how old the Earth was. Mm. Many of them, too many of them, said 6,000 years old because they were young Earth creationists still.
Yeah.
Right? Stuff like that falls under cultural stagnation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The second one, this is super low-hanging fruit, sadly. Religious and spiritual abuse and trauma. So when people have experienced religious or spiritual abuse by religious leaders, by religious institutions or individuals, or through religious means, whether that's feeling judged for someone's identity, being humiliated for what they've been told is sinful, whether they're kind of surviving from purity culture, or they have a controlling leader, or they've witnessed the moral failings of a leader. So this is based on data we've collected, and some people said, you know, after everything that happened with the Catholic priests, I can no longer identify as a Catholic.
And you're practicing, right? You're seeing patients, and I mentioned this to you earlier, so I know the answer, but you're seeing plenty of religious abuse and trauma in your practice.
Yeah, it's something that my group practice, the Flourishing Collective, is specializing in, largely because, one, it's West Michigan, but two, there's a significant number of people that have experienced trauma and abuse and then also been cast out by their own community that is the people that they love the most. And there's a level of sacred trauma that occurs with like the idea or belief of the sacred or God and how those beliefs and teachings have to be deconstructed to sort of almost reshape and understand a theological identity. But then there's also another layer in which it also impacts every single component of a relationship, whether it's parents or spouses or children, coworkers, or even people's jobs. And so there is something I think unique about spiritual and religious trauma that is different or adjacent to other trauma as well, because you're also talking about the way in which people experience it's their worldview being shattered, but it's also the ultimate sacred being shattered. And so a lot of the therapists that work for me and that we work together is we're helping people establish all of their existential realities that they're living with I like to say those rather than fears, because fears make them seem scary. Mm-hmm. They're more realities. So these existential realities that we live with, we're not afraid to talk about. We're also helping them trying to answer them for themselves, because that's the other piece, is people that have experienced spiritual abuse and trauma. And I loved the video in the beginning about the things she's raising, not raising her daughter in. Is those are the things that I'm like, I would love to work myself out of a job and I wouldn't be needed anymore. And I think about...
So a lot of the things in the TikTok remind you of things that you
that
hear
I
in your practice.
See all the time, right? The ways in which people don't know they have a choice over what they believe. And how autonomy is so freeing. It's, it's one of the existential fears, right? Or realities is our freedom. But to never have felt it and to be a 40-year-old woman going through it, it has cascading effects of that.
And the freedom can be exhilarating and scary.
Oh,
right?
it's both at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We got two more to do. You mentioned this one already.
Yeah.
Probably not a lot more to say.
Yeah, when religious teachings give overly simplistic views of suffering, whether that's toxic positivity or the prosperity gospel, this belief in a just world that, good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people, totally fine if good things are happening to you. But then when bad things happen to you, that suggests you're a bad person, and our human psychology doesn't work that way. So something has to give. And then the fourth, this one is where people no longer want to be identified as religious because religion carries connotations that they no longer themselves feel comfortable with. So a poll came out 2 years ago. I was fascinated by this. They polled self-described evangelicals, and they asked them a very simple question. Do you believe in the deity of Jesus? And 40% of self-identified evangelicals do not believe in the deity of Jesus. Now, I'm not a theologian, but I'm pretty sure that's the only thing you needed to believe as an evangelical is that Jesus is God. And so if 40% do not believe in that, what's that suggesting is that for at least 2/5 of the individuals who identify as evangelical, it's more of a socio-political term than it is a religious term.
Yeah. I love that point. I was teaching somewhere on Christian nationalism, and I said, randomly, it feels to me like evangelical is becoming more of a political term than a religious term. Mm-hmm. And people were really shocked at that idea. So
now you have the data.
Exactly. I'm glad to know that I got it right that time, every once in a while.
So the clip I used here, which I love, just won't work on an audio-only platform, but I do have this TikTok quote from a gentleman in which he said, I accidentally combined all good and no worries and said all worries, and it's the most honest thing I've said all year. Yeah. All right. Back to the gathering.
I just like to give people a little break,
We all need a hit of dopamine every
exactly.
once in a while.
Exactly. That's what that is, isn't it?
That's right.
It's just a hit of dopamine.
Yeah.
Science. So let's talk about what it's like. The experience of pulling away from religion. We've said it's hard. We've said why it's hard. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, and maybe we would preface this by saying it's not often that people are like really excited. Like if you've been raised religious, they're not like very excited to be like, I think I'm going to change the entire way I see the world and completely alter my identity, right? This is a challenging process.
Often very painful.
Yeah, very, very
it's
painful.
Not, and I would say this, most people, at least myself, I didn't go in being like, that's what I want to do. And it's exactly like, I see a way forward. It was like, I think if I look back, I probably clung to it maybe 15 years too long, but it's what I did, right? Like it's, and so I think there's some versions of this, too, that I think I want to bring, like, a compassionate voice to around this of, like, it's really painful. And so if you guys are going through that or have been through that or on one side or another side or both sides, it just to name that, it's very painful. And the fact that even you would show up today to even talk about it or hear about it, like, that says something, too.
So we tend to think about religious deconstruction as the process of breaking down, analyzing, questioning, and struggling with your religious worldview, right? So this is kind of like you're going point by point, figuring out whether or not the things you've been taught and what you believe hold up to the empirical evidence of your own life.
And this is our attempt at defining this because it has not been defined actually psychologically. Everyone sort of throws this term around colloquially or on the TikTok, but not scientifically. So this is our attempt.
It starts here,
and
it can go in two different ways, basically, right?
Right, you can go in different ways. So some people who deconstruct will reconstruct, and you'll still land within religion. So whether that's you switch religions, or you just have a radically different version of your current religion that has some vestiges of the old one, but looks radically different, that's reconstruction. You've kind of rebuilt some version of that religion. But other people decide they don't want to stay, or some people do not stay religious, maybe even though they wanted to, and they de-identify from religion. And this is the process of leaving religion altogether, right? And so this could be towards atheism, toward agnosticism, or, and this is where we kind of take it a step further, a lot of people aren't quite done with the spiritual component. And so they might be looking for some post-religious spirituality, some type of spiritual connection.
Okay. That's seeking non-religious spirituality.
You got it.
Boom.
You got it.
My bad. I went to the next one too quickly.
It's okay. So when we're kind of thinking about what is the process of leaving religion like, it looks different for everybody, and you can think it could be disbelieving things, so changing your beliefs about God or about core theological principles. It can be what's called disengagement, and this is where you like emotionally withdraw or you no longer feel that relational connection with God or the sacred.
You may still be attending, right? You may still have religious behavior, but you're not connected in that way.
Yeah, it feels kind of empty.
Mm-hmm.
The discontinuance is where you decide you no longer want to follow the moral mandates of religion. So religion tells you to do something, and you say, I'm okay, I'm going to do something else. And then disaffiliation is the social component. So this is where you would withdraw from a religious community, stop going to church, a Bible study, a temple, synagogue, mosque, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And in all these cases, some more than others, this religious residue remains and plays a role in people's lives, even when they've de-identified or reconstructed, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to brag on Daryl. This is a term that he came up with, which I think is super cool. And
Agreed.
So everyone should, because I just think whenever you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, that's what it is.
It's so
and
true.
And
it's very real.
And it was something,
real.
I think it was one of your landmark papers that came out.
She's very sweet. She's also said this is the best idea I'll ever have. So it's all downhill from
pretty
me.
Pretty good. Solid.
But I love that. It's very
okay.
sweet.
Wait, I don't know. You may have another one, but this is pretty good.
Yeah.
The bar is high.
The bar is high. Well, with that introduction, I'll just try to give you a very, very brief overview. So basically, this was the thing that we were very shocked by. We predicted it, but we were shocked. Essentially, people who have left religion more closely mirror the currently religious than people who have never been religious before, if that makes sense. So there's vestiges of your religious past that are really, really, really hard to shake. So if you've left religion, you will still think, act, feel in ways that are decidedly religious, even if you don't want to.
It's like the Catholic guilt, right? People will say that, like, oh, it's just my Catholic guilt.
But
they're really, they're really talking about religious residue.
That's exactly what Sarah and I call it is who moved the toothpaste. So we, in our bathroom for like 11 years, the toothpaste has been on my side of the cabinet, right? And so like a few months ago, we moved it to her side.
Because it was really annoying. It just wasn't efficient.
It was just with flow. You get it. Okay.
So we decided this was going to make our life better.
Yeah. So if you were to ask me, where's the toothpaste? I'd say, well, it's on Sarah's side of the cabinet. Every single night, and I will do it again tonight without fail, where do you think I'm going to look for the toothpaste? My side. And every time I go, and then I go over there every single night. Why? Well, it's because that's where the toothpaste has always been. Okay, what does this have to do with religion? If you've had a certain way of viewing the world, and you decide, I'm not religious anymore, it's not like your brain's like, great, the way we've been wired for our entire life, we'll just change on a dime. right? You've got well-worn paths. Psychologists call these schemas, right? They're mental frameworks of seeing the world. They're very, very hard to change.
And the more traumatic and rigid and strict and fundamental, the harder they are to change. So much so that you may just, you have to, what I try to help my clients see is not just replace those very strict, fundamental, polarized beliefs with something new, because those pathways are so worn, and it's very hard to do.
Yeah, William James has a great quote. He says, a great many people think they are thinking when they're merely rearranging their prejudices. Oof, that's a tough one. I'll let you think about that one. But like Sarah said, we have some evidence that religious fundamentalists, when they leave religion, they just get fundamentalist about something else. And don't throw me out because I've got the mic, but one of the things they do get really fundamentalist about, this is where I'm going to lose half of you, are politics. Womp, womp. Right? I know, I'm sorry.
But they're right this time. That's the good news.
This time they're right. This time they're right.
About everything.
About everything.
Because we always are right about everything.
Hang in there with me for a second. If you were raised in a religious fundamentalist place where what they valued was adherence to the group, totality of conformity, and ideological purity, and you really hated people who didn't agree, and then you leave that because you're like, they're so intolerant, and then you become really politically liberal where there's everyone believing the same thing, ideological purity, and you really hate people on the other side, I hate to say it, you haven't changed. You've just rearranged the target of your vitriol. That's all you've done. And I'm sorry, you can meet me in the parking lot with a sock full of nickels, but that's what the data are saying. Okay.
A sock full of nickels?
Just in case they want to beat me up.
I see. Yeah. That was a surprise. It's a throwback. I didn't know people were still doing that. One thing that I thought of as you were saying that's an that I think might be an example of this, is cancel culture on the left seems to be about purity, right? Which can be about fundamentalism. And so it's a critique that I think is legitimate.
It
might be tied somewhat to this.
In the same way, you could never be religious enough unless you had read, if we're talking evangelical Christianity, unless you had done your quiet time, you had had your mountaintop experience, I can't tell you how many times I went to a church service, they do an altar call, and I'm like, maybe I'm not saved, and I go down again, right, just to repunch the ticket, right? And now, instead, it's like, well, what's the new cause I have to care about now? What's the new virtue signaling I need to make sure everybody knows I'm really aware of? You know, what's the new issue that I have to put forth? Rather than having those things be driven by my own values.
It's more complicated to do it that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel as good, to be honest.
It doesn't. No, that's right. It doesn't.
Well, speaking of, I just wanted to say, have you say something quickly about this, because there's this study, right, where you have people who are done but still practicing.
That's right.
And then you have, I think the other one was discontinued duns, right? And it turns out those who are still practicing, meaning probably
still
maybe
attending.
A part of a religious community attending but not really believing anymore, that those folks actually have poor mental health.
Yeah, it's
still practicing.
Still practicing. Yeah. And I think if I look back right on my own story, that was a lived experience that makes a lot of sense intuitively, is that there's a period of time when you're leaving religion, you're deconstructing. Maybe you're still practicing because you have pressures of community, or you're still trying to sort it out yourself. That's the time the worst mental health occurs. It's still when you leave, it doesn't bounce right back. It's still very painful, but it's not as painful as people that are still practicing. So one thing I tend to do in my practice is I actually encourage people to take, it's funny, it's actually Lent's here, right? Okay. I can tell a little funny story. Is I encourage them to give up Christianity for Lent, and practice actually putting that on the shelf and giving yourself that time to take a break, and then see what voices and people and places emerge on the other side of it. Because if you're still in it, you're just activated all the time, and you can't quite sort out what actually you believe because you're so busy fighting the things you don't believe anymore. And so taking some time away. So I actually did that. Was it 2020? Yeah, in 2020, I had a little bit of a temper tantrum and threw around all my books I was reading, and I was really fussy, and I looked at Daryl in my very dramatic form that I tend to be in, and I'm like, I'm going to give up Christianity for Lent. And he were like, wait, what? And I was like, I'm going to try it. Let's see what happens. And it was the most cleansing, healing experience for me. And to be honest, I remember a friend she was like, oh, so what are you doing for Easter? And I was like, oh, it's already Easter. So I kept it on for a little bit longer.
It's sort of like, I sort of think of it, this intuitively makes sense to me, right? Because you're really torn, mm-hmm. right? You're sort of staying in a world you've left or are trying to leave. Mm-hmm. But another way to think of it, I think, is maybe like you're going back and getting more residue on you yeah. that you then have to get rid of later, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yeah, I was following a bunch of people on Instagram that I think that were just, again, really important voices for what I needed when I was still practicing to help me get to that place. But I realized, and this is where I would also encourage you, it's also okay if those voices and places and spaces only serve a purpose and a time for that purpose and time. And it's okay to take a break and mute them all for a little bit to let yourself see, okay, whose voices are you actually missing? And so then you get to choose it rather than just like, I was feeling like so reactionary about everyone else's trauma. I wasn't providing the emotional space or capacity, and I didn't have the capacity to process my own. And so it's important to take that time.
Okay, another quick dopamine hit before we get to the existential chasm. And this fits with getting to the existential chasm. Quick read that. This is very short. Okay. Okay, the existential chasm. What is that?
Yeah, so the existential chasm is how I conceptualize thinking. If you've left religion, right, and religion is this existential cultural worldview that addresses all these core big questions of life and kind of manages anxiety, and you've left that. Now you have to reface those core existential questions again without the comfort of religion, right? And so what happens is you have to face these fears afresh, and it's without that kind of sturdy structure. And so oftentimes people haven't often developed the necessary critical thinking skills or that type of muscle required to answer these core questions if they've had the answers given to them in a religious worldview. And so it's incredibly terrifying to face these fears afresh. So imagine you thought or you believed in an afterlife, and now you're not too sure. Okay, not only are you grieving the fact that there might not be an afterlife, which is, you don't have many decades left, right? Even the youngest among us, right? And you're like, well, I had, comforted myself that I was going to see grandma in the afterlife. Well, that's gone now. So now you're grieving grandma again, right? And then if you're like, well, gosh, I'm in my mid-40s and I made all these high-impact behavioral decisions about where to go to college, whom to marry, kind of, what I did or didn't do with my body, what I'm doing with my profession, and now I don't believe any of this is true, then you kind of have this midlife meltdown. So truthfully, the existential chasm is this idea that you're refacing existential concerns without the structures of religion, and it can produce guilt and shame and anxiety and fear and awe and wonder and, curiosity. It's kind of both of those things together. So there are some deep costs of being a religious dun or being someone who's gone through deconstruction, because it's going to open you up to all kinds of existential anxiety, to which we would say probably the best way to deal with that is to cultivate an existential distress tolerance. So just become comfortable with uncertainty, become comfortable with the existential dread that nags at least me daily. Just become comfortable with the realities of those big questions.
Well, that's where I try to change it, right? Trying to change it from even just how I approach it, right? It's an existential fear to more, it's an existential reality. So there's also some really beautiful things that come from facing these existential realities, right? There's all these really cool studies about how you put a couple in the middle of a graveyard and they start to forgive each other faster and work towards reconciliation faster, So I will say this. Sometimes when I'm pissed at different people, maybe you, I drive through a graveyard.
Science.
And so if you ever see me in the graveyard, you probably don't want to come near me because I'm really upset. But just trying to develop these things, it's it sort of then can help also be so empowering of like there's an anchor too of like this, they're just, we're all actually experiencing this together. And so if we start to talk about it, it's less isolating. If we start to gather, we start to realize and ask you, like, ask how does it feel to be, not have a complete answer in a nice package. Like, we start to normalize that. It becomes, I think, less terrifying and more reality-based.
Yeah, I have seen and heard a lot of thinkers say, basically, this is maybe impossible for most people. Most people, and I'm very skeptical of this view, but maybe it's just because I don't like it. Maybe that's all it is, which is that we can't really make most of humanity non-religious. Too many people need the crutch of religion, right? And I think what this says here is, yes, it's hard, but there is a path in which, if you work at it, right, if you consciously work at, what is it, distress tolerance, it does get better. And I mean, I can say personally, as someone who's been deconstructing for a long, long time, probably 10, 15 years, if I looked back far enough, it does get easier, to be honest. I mean, it got easier for me. Like right now, my stresses are not related to previous religious commitments, right? My stress is about my family sometimes. Right now it's about my country, right? About the world, about the hurting people of the world. So I still have distresses, but those have receded with time. But we're talking about quite a long time. We're not talking about months.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and time with probably behavioral, intentional decisions that you had to make to change things, right? Because if we just allowed time to heal it, I wish it was that way. Right. But we have to almost, I think the thing I'll say about distress is it's like building a muscle. It's like if you've ever been to the gym and you need to do some like weightlifting or you're doing, it's like it hurts. And it often hurts, but that's what's making it stronger. And so even trying to say it like this, of like even reframing it of like, I'm actually really upset because I know what, I remember this, I know what it feels like right after the altar call and be like, I punched my ticket. I don't have that feeling anymore. And on one hand, that's, I miss the certainty. And then on the other hand, I also think there's an authenticity to me that I have now where I can say, yeah, I don't know. And there's a relatable humanity of like being able to endure that not knowing that I didn't have when I kept punching that ticket.
For a while I had an app on my phone, I'm trying to remember what it was called. I think it was called We Croak. And every day it would get, you know this?
Yeah, isn't it like a few times a day it reminds you you're going to die?
Correct.
Yeah.
It
reminds you you're going
to
die, but then also gives you like quotes about death and the meaning of life and digging into life and making the most of it. Well, and it was, I think it helps.
It shows it helps.
No, I mean, I had a friend who had this app.
There's data that it helps?
And what he did is it came like three or five times a day, and whenever it came, he'd ask himself, am what I'm doing right now, is that meaningful? Right, so if it came and he's like watching Maury Povich, he's like, nope, right? And he just like gets up and like he's like, I'm not, I don't need
is
to watch
Maury
a talk show.
That is an old reference. Maury Povich?
Yeah. Is he like, still with us?
You're watching Phil Donahue,
Phil Donahue
and...
but if the reminder comes and he's on TikTok, right, is that how he wants to spend his time? Or if the reminder comes and he's with his daughter and son...
That hurt a little bit.
Yeah,
he's
know,
on TikTok.
Go back to Maury.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, one of the things, so when Sarah and I wrote a book about suffering and just these existential questions, death has a way of cutting out all the nonsense. If you've ever been around, like, people in hospice or people who are around people who are dying, there's not time for this nonsense, right? We're not worried about stuff that we get worried about. Oh, does someone like me? You know, like, should I have the chocolate cake? Eat the chocolate cake, right? Like, it cuts that stuff out. So reminders of death, it's this weird thing. By making something scarce, it's more valuable, right? There's not a lot of diamonds, so it's valuable. If time is scarce, if your life is scarce, it has to be more valuable, which is why I've always been so confused why death, people are so afraid if you die, life doesn't have any meaning. The fact that you die is precisely the thing that gives life meaning. If it went on forever, then you'd always be able to do it tomorrow, cultivate that relationship tomorrow, run that marathon tomorrow. But the fact that it is a precious resource is precisely what gives this life so much meaning, because you're giving your valuable time and attention to things.
So a lot of people still do have spiritual yearning after de-identifying, leaving. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the ways that people are experimenting?
Yeah, go maybe to the we'll next jump one. To the next one.
Sounds
so my colleagues and I have a grant right now where we're looking at how non-religious individuals are trying to satisfy these existential needs for meaning. So what are non-religious sources of spirituality? And when we kind of cast this in the framework of religious residue, realizing that for many people, they're probably going to look for things that seem to resemble religion. These are some of the things that we're seeing where people might try to find some new meaning. So one place is in religion-adjacent experiences. So how many of you have heard of the Enneagram before? The Enneagram, great, yes. So a lot of times people are like, hey, that's a way that I can try to make sense of my life and spirituality, but it's not religion. But it kind of seems like religion. Like one way you can find out if someone's an ex-evangelical is to ask them what their Enneagram number is, right? And if they tell you what that is, you're like, okay, you've left the church.
That's me as well. I did Enneagram for a while as well. And it was helpful,
yeah,
and I did enjoy it.
It can be very helpful. Yeah. There's a second way of non-religious spirituality, so connecting in nature with other people, to the cosmos.
I mean, psychedelics is a part of that, right? That's another wave that we're seeing currently is, right, the influx of psychedelic use, trying to interact with something greater, but not in a formalized sort of religious capacity.
I also thought when you were talking about those well-worn paths, mm-hmm. I remember Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics. He talked about how sometimes psychedelics can, so if you think of them as snow paths that you sled down, psychedelics can throw fresh snow on those paths mm-hmm. that allow you to maybe build some different paths, right? Maybe to get rid of some of that religious residue, perhaps.
And then I think some people, we talked about politics already, and then some people look for new spiritual leaders. I think one thing that I feel pretty passionate about is I have a sense of compassion for people who have left religion who might be particularly vulnerable to leaders and charismatic individuals who might want to exploit them. And so because of religious residue, we might be looking for someone to tell us what to believe or what to do with our lives. And in America, I do think that there is a place to capitalize on that, and I mean that in the terms of, like, capitalism, right? There's a lot of money to be made, and I get nervous about that. And so whenever we give talks like this, we try to remind people, be aware if you feel drawn towards charismatic leaders who are trying to sell you a new path to spiritual enlightenment. They're just probably recreating some
spiritual trauma, religious trauma for you.
Yeah.
So I think it's something, too, right, around the work of what it actually feels like to ask yourself in a community of different people what you believe, not what you're told you should believe. And that is distressing and all sorts of things, too. But, yes, I too, feel very passionate about this because we're vulnerable. It's very painful.
I'm trying to find one thing that I wanted to look at. It's not that, though. I'm going to do this. It seems like existentialism as a philosophy is something you're at least advocating in the book and in some of the things we've said here as well, right? Like taking responsibility, living out of a value-based as opposed to like a belief-based. I just love this. I think I pulled this from your book. Just the idea that I think for people it's tough to imagine that the anchor could be themselves and their own intuition, their own sense of what is good and true and right, right? So while also using, hopefully, lots of resources and smart people like yourselves and philosophers and other people, that you can craft a life that you like with values that you chose that feel authentic to you, right? Do you want to say a little bit about that? I also have maybe I'll maybe play this clip in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the goal, right? So the goal is to create an authentic life that is aligned with your values so you can feel like you're a person of integrity. And my encouragement would be to cultivate those values that are facing outward of the self, right? That are self-transcendent. So religion is about self-transcendence, but so many things are about self-transcendence, right? About bettering the lives of other people, asking yourself, what have I done today to make the world more loving, more just, more fair, more compassionate, more generous, more grateful, and actively working to take ownership over that.
And I think that's where I would say, too, Josh, that's then what is meaningful, right? And so when you can ask and face and accept those realities, even to the degree that we can as humans, it then enriches our lives to be where we can sort of live that outward life towards things that are greater, providing us with this beautiful gift of meaning and purpose, even when in such a different form than maybe we could have imagined before.
I'm going to play just a quick clip here that is illustrative of what we were just saying. It's from a podcast called, I think it's Homebrewed Christianity with Trip Fuller. It's interesting. I haven't listened to it in a long time. He's a process theologian. And he had Aaron Simmons on, who's a professor of philosophy, wrote a book called Camping with Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard's sort of the father of existentialism. He's an existentialist. And he has this nice summation, I think, of the way he chooses to live, which I think goes really well with kind of what we're advocating here.
What goes on in existence is always a risky venture. And so when I say what's worthy of your finitude, I'm trying to get across the two, I think, fundamental key qualities of human existence. And those are, we are relational and we are vulnerable. So our relationality means that we are always in a social context. We are always with others. And not just with them, but maybe responsible for them. Hence the idea of neighbor love being in fact commanded in the Christian scriptures, right? Mm-hmm. And then our vulnerability is the idea that in this shared context with others, we necessarily don't have an infinite amount of time, so we've got to make the most of the time we have.
Yeah.
And that task is a task of meaning making. So we need to rethink the value by which we understand our selfhood, understand our existence. So in the book, I differentiate between two orientations, existential orientations. One is a success orientation and one is a faithfulness orientation. And hence the subtitle of the book, Faithfulness as a Way of Life. And so the success orientation, we all know what this is, right? Go get your paper, get the big car, make sure your house is bigger than other people's, check the box, get the PhD, read more books. It's all about
hashtag winning.
But the idea is faithfulness, risk with direction, is all about, it's about becoming. It's about who is it you hope to have been? Who are you becoming? My understanding of faithfulness is living toward what you take to matter and then doing that with everything you've got.
So I just love this small thing of risk with direction. I just think that's such a great shorthand for a different way of thinking about faith or faithfulness than what we're used to. And so I was appreciative of that from him. We're going to open it up for questions. Chris is going to come up and take this mic from me. Raise your hand. I'll get to you as fast as I can. Perfect.
Is good and evil a Christian concept, or can you say something about that sense of good and evil that...
No, I don't think good and evil is a Christian concept. I don't even think good and evil is a religious concept. I think that good and evil is what's moral, what's immoral. And I think morality, even animals know about morality. Like, even animals have moral codes. I think that religions have a particular way of thinking about and treating good and evil and incorporating that into us believing that certain people are all good and certain people are all bad, rather than acknowledging that the dividing line between good and evil probably cuts through all of our hearts.
So a lot of your comments seem to be oriented towards the U.S. and maybe Western countries, what we call Western countries. Have you thought about or do you have a view on different parts of the world at the same time?
You get to talk about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've collected data from the United States, Netherlands, Hong Kong, New Zealand, United Kingdom. So we've kind of collected data from many countries, not, you know, nowhere near all the countries. And we see similar patterns in all of those different countries. And I would say there are certain parts of the world that are becoming increasingly more religious, right? And then there are also pockets in the U.S. of certain religious affiliations or faith traditions that are becoming more popular, that are actually growing. But in the U.S., as a majority Christianity, a majority Christian nation, that's where we're seeing most of the folks leaving.
Dear Sarah, I believe I heard you say in 2020 you wanted to put Christianity on the shelf. Did I hear that right?
Oh, for my Lent practice?
Yes.
That's what I did for Lent in 2020, yes.
2020 was the same year you were completely instrumental in helping our LGBTQ population get a non-discrimination ordinance written the right way in City Hall. I'm being a little facetious, but do you think there's a connection?
That's interesting, Karen. I have to think about that. Thank you for saying that. It's very sweet. It's interesting. Yeah, I have to think about that. I think it probably absolutely is connected in those ways. I think, and I love that Jay and Dave are here too. I think the love and the community that I found before 2020 was in a way more Christian loving than the Christian community I thought I had. And I think that's probably what gave me the courage to set the community aside. And so I think the beliefs had been there shifting, and I was that unhealthy person that was still practicing. And so I think you're right, Karen. It probably did. I have not thought about that. Thank you for that.
So far, only questions from the front. I do just want to say I am mobile and can get to the back, so let me know.
You commented on evangelical kind of becoming a word that, if I heard it right, was kind of amorphous. I think the word Christian is very much the same way now. Your thoughts on how the word Christian is used?
I mean, I agree with you. I find myself even if, you know, trying to feel like, or trying to say, oh, not like that or like this or, you know, and it feels that I saw a shift. I don't know if you have the data to talk about it, but I saw the shift around 2020 or 2016, that shifting around Christian nationalism and what that looks like. I know, like Kristen Dumais' book, Jesus and John Wayne, talks about that. I don't know if you have any.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're exactly right. Sarah's right on that. A lot of people, I think, would rather say, I don't want to run the risk of me identifying as a Christian and you misperceiving it. So I'd rather just say, no, I'm not, but then secretly in my own mind kind of work out that maybe I am, but it just looks differently. And I think that's very, very common, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, socially, that makes a lot of sense. An alternative could be to reclaim what that means, right? So if someone says, are you a Christian? You would say, I am, and let me explain to you how. That is why I care about these things. That's why I do these things. That's why I am completely uncertain, but I've replaced the word faith with trust, those types of things. But that's harder too. That's a collective action problem, right? That's like you have to get a bunch of people together to say, like, we are going to take back the word Christian and make it mean these things. Because if you're just out there on your own, they're like, oh, you're a Christian. I know everything there is to know about you.
We
Thank you. I'm wondering if, well, there's a lot of things I'm wondering now, but I'm wondering if the conditions for human flourishing, it seems to me one of two things would be true. Either the conditions for human flourishing are embedded into reality, and we, through life experience, come to or need to or struggle to align ourselves with what that flourishing means. We have to discover, as it were, what is that alignment in my life that enables me to flourish? Or the conditions for human flourishing are only what I determine they are. Does that sound like a distinction? That is, it's embedded in reality, and if I would press it, then I'm wondering, so the object of, or the purpose of religion or religions is to tell you what those conditions are, to give language to those conditions, to give structures to those conditions. Now you have a nice, neat box. Take the box away, take the schema away, the conditions for human flourishing are still there, but I'm floundering my way, or discovering my way, or living my way into it. I'm finding it, and every human being has to so find it to flourish. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm going to say it's a both and you're going to be upset about me for that. Because I think I was following you and saying in what you were saying around. Is it this thing that's prescribed that's out there, or is it this internal discovered? And I think it's both. I think finding the connect. I think there's a lot of religious practices, if I'll be honest, that I was a part of as a child that was not meant for my flourishing. Instead, it was meant for, I think, authority figures flourishing and pocketbooks and things like that. I think if it's... I try to, and I think a lot of people get frustrated with that. I don't want to do like broad strokes. Like, so religion is bad, and I think it can be good. I just think we've found a lot of bad. And I also think, and this I think is incredibly controversial, I think humans possess at our core level, like, we are good and we have goodness in us. I think we've just been convinced, or there's generational trauma, or there's all kinds of things we don't even understand that we've interpreted through this lens of good and bad or evil. And so I think it is in us and discoverable and is. And we've been so talked out of it. And I'm also super fascinated by epigenetics and how this transforms. Like, so if I think about like, so there's a part of trauma work is understanding like your place in your life and the trauma you're gone through in the context of others and in the situation, whether it's familiar trauma or your child's trauma, all collectively. And so something I also like to think about is like spiritual trauma. And so like when I think about my dad's story of why he found the Jesus movement is because he was raised by an alcoholic mom. And so he found someone that gave him this paternalistic solution of like X, Y, and Z in this box. You can check it and then you'll know you're good. And so when I can start to think about why I was handed this spiritual inheritance, I can start to piece apart a little bit more with compassion that I understand what I was taught maybe about myself isn't actually what's inherent in me. So it's a very long-winded to say both and, I think, and I don't know if that answers any to it.
I mean, I don't know that I could top that. I mean, that was good. Okay. I mean, the only other metaphor that we've kind of talked about before, so Jonathan Haidt, who's a social psychologist, most people know for the anxious generation, but if you like go back, one of his first books was called The Happiness Hypothesis. He said, humans are like plants. You just got to get the conditions right. Right? So that's kind of there's something inherent, and you have to get the conditions right.
But
and
we've been put in a lot of really piss poor, sorry, but I can't say that. Yeah. Conditions, yeah. I can say that. Yeah. Okay, great. I've been really trying my best.
so it could be, so what religion could say is you need sun, you need water, you need fertilizer, right? But then it also could also be the case that religion's like, you know, we need sun, you know, 23 hours a day of sun. Well, that's not how, you know what I'm saying? So it's...
Yeah, or maybe you're a shade plant.
Yeah, and that's where the... right, maybe you're a shade plant. And that's where I think knowing yourself, right? Maybe I'm more of a shade plant, right? Maybe I just need... maybe I'm a cactus. I just need a little bit of water. Or maybe I'm a water lily and I need more. So it seems like it's the both.
That's a good illustration.
I just want to recommend a book, possibly, if you're interested. We were talking about... you were mentioning that you think people are inherently good. There's a lot of goodness in us, right? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there's both in us, right? Obviously. But there's a book by Rutger Bregman, is his name. He's a Dutch historian. It's called Humankind, meaning, and he's talking about from an evolutionary perspective sort of a new, a somewhat new idea, which is that it was really our kindness, our willingness to work together in groups that contributed to our growth as human beings and our survival as Homo sapiens, that it was essential that we were kind to one another and learned to work together, right? Which cuts against, obviously, religious dogma.
Yeah, and it may also be a lovely way of thinking about the hopelessness we feel around in our political environment is what would kind look like, right? I love Brené Brown's idea of kindness. It's like it's a soft front and a strong spine. And I sometimes hold that in my mind of like, yeah, what does it look to have a soft front but a strong spine to know when is it turn into something else?
The progress existentialism I have to keep up with my neighbors. The humans are meaning-making animals. Religion gives us a package system for that. Existentialism says we can break that down and live in some of that anxious space without having everything figured out. And you've encouraged us to think about using our own value formation as a potentially a more enriching way to pursue that. And yet we seek meaning-making in community. How does one pursue defining their own values in a way that isn't just one of the recycled ways of church that we talked about? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Especially as it relates to a community of people doing it together.
I was going to say, I love that. Because if we just do our own value work, it's really ego work, which we need, right? We need to be clear about what is our soft front and strong spine, what is our own goodness, but and looking out to a communal sense. And so to use Karen's example, I think one of the most Christian things I had been a part of in Holland, Michigan, was the non-discrimination ordinance. I think it was one of the most acts of loving kindness, and it was orchestrated by people of all walks of life coming together and saying, this is what we value for our community, and it's worth sticking up for, putting our neck out, giving our time, our resources, our money, our reputation for. And it transformed our city, and it's a legacy that the city will have. And so I think ego work and internalized work is important, and it can't stop there. And so as far as the six-step plan, I don't have one. I think this gathering and gatherings like this is the way to start. I love what you said is how to be attuned or aware of when it just starts replicating those sort of power structures. Because something is I have maybe gone through different other phases of deconstruction and reconstruction, because I think in some ways it's can feel like a little bit of a spiral, and I think that's beautiful and hard at the same time, is I think sometimes we as humans, one of the conditions we get wrong is power. And that often can be found, and we want a clear leader and a clear director. And so being attentive to each other, and I love the a framework of kindness, of thinking about that as a value, as a virtue, and holding maybe communal virtues. And part of that communal virtue is also honesty with each other when we violate those virtues. Because I also think part of being human is being experimental and making mistakes too. But there's this, if there's a commitment to a community, there also has to be a commitment to honesty too. Yes?
I've started to think about my life as an experiment that I'm carrying out. And so I titled my Substack, An Experimental Life. And it takes some of the pressure off me if I just think, like, I'm living a human experiment, and I'm allowed to screw up and try things and have them not work and then try other things, you know? I just tried to take some pressure off myself.
There's someone right
there. Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you.
I've been dying to say something. Daryl, I met Daryl because he visited our community, a community that I belong to in Grand Haven, and presented some of this information. And it's a community that about 10 years ago or 15 years ago set aside beliefs. So I'm glad to hear you talk about values, because I think a problem with packaged religion is they package beliefs. And our community over a decade ago put those aside, because there were, like you mentioned, some community, or your experience being with people from all walks of life and, quote, other religions. And we asked ourselves, what do we have in common? And they were values. And the thing that sustains our community is a reminder that these values are more important than a belief system. And I've come to the conclusion that, actually, I asked Daryl this question: what is the root word for religion? What does it mean? Do you remember what you said?
To bind. To bind
yeah,
together.
To come together, right? And so it has nothing to do with Christianity, or Buddhism, or Hinduism. It's people coming together. And the problem is that, as I see it, is that religion has commodified that and packaged it and sold it to people who have fears. Anyway, I had to say what my experience is, and it really is an example of some of the things that you're talking about in terms of how to. And so we're a community of duns, but we flourish because we have this list of values that remind ourselves that's what's important, and that's what community should be about, not a belief.
Yeah. Thank you. So in April, when we meet again, we're going to be at Port 393. That's where we're going to be permanently after this. I'm going to end with just a quick story from this gentleman. His name is Zach Woods. He's an actor. He's hilarious, okay? But this is not a hilarious story. This is a meaningful, fun story to end with.
In The Velveteen Rabbit, this toy rabbit hears the word real and doesn't know what it means. So he goes to the Skin Horse, which is a very frightening name for a toy, but the Skin Horse is this old, wise toy in the nursery who's always kind to the rabbit. And the rabbit asks the Skin Horse, what is real? And the horse says, real is what happens when a child loves you for a very, very long time. Not just to play with, but really loves you. And the rabbit takes that in, and then he says, does it hurt? And the horse says, sometimes, because the horse is always honest. And he says, but when you're real, you don't mind being hurt. And the rabbit says, does it happen quickly? Is it like being wound up? Or is it bit by bit? And the horse says, generally, it takes a really long time to become real. And it doesn't happen to toys that break easily or that have to be carefully kept or that have sharp edges. And usually by the time you're real, all your fur has been loved off, and your joints are wobbly, and your eyes are coming loose, and you're very shabby. But when you're real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. And I love that passage, and I think it's so beautiful and helps me get through the night. And so rather than just making dumbass videos, I figured I'd share that story with you guys and see how that goes.
I love that idea. Sometimes I love the idea of just becoming human. Can I become fully human? And what does that entail? Daryl and Sarah, it's been a real pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.